Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We have a special program today. It's going to be divided into three sections. I'm not going to do health and nutrition because I'm going to do an honest look at Obama's legacy. No, this has nothing to do with the controversy right now that is all over the internet about Obama allegedly doing crack cocaine and then having sex with another man. That's none of my business, nor do I believe it's any of anyone's business. That's his and his wife's business. It may be true, may not be true. I don't care, all right? Just I wouldn't care what his religion was. That's his business. Instead, I'm raising legitimate concerns about his legacy, as we should about anyone who's in a position of power, and the outcome of that power usage is either constructive or destructive. We begin with a 2014 poll from university that ranked Obama as the worst president since World War II. 40% is all that approved of his handling of the economy, 37% for foreign policy, 40% for health care, 40% for handling the environment, and 44% for having a competent administration. But now let's go into the details. On his foreign policy legacy, Obama directly was responsible for the current Ukrainian-Russian conflict due to his administration's secret coup against a constitutional democratically selected president in Ukraine. In Libya, although the highest estimate is that there were upwards of 25,000 people since the Libyan invasion by NATO under Barack Obama's direction in 2011, you're talking about 25,000 of its citizens were killed. But how many were displaced? Libya went from being, of all 54 countries in Africa, the longest life expectancy, rivaling the United States, the highest percentage of citizens who had full good educations, including college educations, is a higher percentage in the United States, that had free health care anywhere in the world where you had a procedure done. If it couldn't be done in Libya, in its state-of-art hospitals, it was paid for. There was no unemployment, zero, because if you couldn't find a job, you were still paid the same wage as if you had that job. You had no crime. Everyone owned a house or an apartment. If you wanted to farm, they bought you all the equipment and seed, and he also created the greatest human-made reservoir of water to help not only Libya, but also the surrounding countries have water that they otherwise would not have had. He also had a central bank system that took a percentage of all the crude oil revenue, and it was directed right into everyone's personal bank account. No other country I'm aware of in the world has done that. And they had freedom where local councils would decide policy in every community. For example, Gaddafi was against capital punishment, but other citizens weren't, so they overruled him. And yet the New York Times praised Gaddafi and praised Libya as the Paris of Africa. And then they destroyed it. And they were giving us all this false information, and all of it's been turned around and shown to be false. And now you can actually buy African slaves in the open markets in Libya. Wow. Obama enabled the Benghazi tragedy on September 11, 2012. There were 9,700 airstrike sorties and 7,700 precision-guided bombs dropped on Libya. 2,500 Americans died in Afghanistan and Iraq during Obama, more than under Bush. Afghanistan, over 40,000 civilians killed during Obama's years, although civilian deaths reached its highest number under Trump in 2018. In Iraq, 92,600 documented civilian deaths during Obama's 8 years. Obama started the military effort for regime change in Syria by funding ISIS and al-Nusra militant groups. And why we had that attack upon the embassy annex in Benghazi was because it was being used. It was closed, but it was being used to illegally take weapons from Gaddafi's arsenal and ship them secretly to northern Israel and Turkey to be used by terrorist groups. So that's why they lied before Congress and congressional investigations. All of them lied because they knew that this was an illegal operation, and it would show that Obama was funding terrorists. Kind of odd, in our war on terrorism, we're funding the enemy. Also, during his eight-year term, he ordered 1,878 drone strikes under his extrajudicial assassination amendment in the National Defense Authorization Act, which, by the way, included the ability to arrest without cause, habeas corpus, and even detain indefinitely, allow no charges to be known to the person arrested, and kill them if he chose to. That was all authorized under the National Defense Authorization Act. Obama had drone strikes responsible for killing 3,100, both combatants and civilians. Trump, on the other hand, had over 2,240 in less than 4 years. Trump also revoked the Obama rule of reporting on drone strike deaths, so the actual number of deaths are unknown. In Yemen, almost 100,000 killed since the conflict was started in March 2015 under Obama. Obama gave all the help that Saudi Arabia needed to go in there and crush the rebellion. In Somalia, the U.S. military intervention in Somalia began at the very end of Bush's presidency in 2007, but escalated under Obama and worrisome under Trump. $1 trillion, I repeat, $1 trillion, Obama approved for new improved nuclear arms. Why would we need that when we had thousands of nuclear arms? Wasn't he the president given the Nobel Peace Prize? Well, how do you justify talking about peace and yet having $1 trillion behind a nuclear arms program? Why not put that into cities? Also, Professor Katz and Professor Krugler from Harvard University and Princeton University, respectively, said that Obama created far more misery outside the United States than within it. He appointed John Brennan as his CIA director, the head torturer. Thus, Obama continued to legitimize torture. But there were other areas as well. What are some of the promises that Obama was very adamant in making, but quiet in breaking? The synthetic opioid deaths really took off during Obama. 67,000 died between 2013 and 2017, and numerous deaths were prevented by being hospitalized, but these were still overdoses. Obama effectively did nothing, I mean zero, to curtail this epidemic, which has only continued to worsen after he left office. He could have opened up drug rehabilitation centers. He could have opened up clinics in every city in the United States to help people get off drugs, and didn't. Obama ran on universal single-payer health care, but that was a complete sham. Universal health care under Medicare would have meant that drugs would have been affordable, and no one could have been charged individually for going into a hospital no matter what the procedure, so hence we wouldn't have all these bankruptcies. But nope. The logs of the White House showed dozens upon dozens of visits by the health insurance and pharmaceutical and hospital agencies, all who were the real architects of his Obamacare. Never once was it considered something that would benefit all the people, because it didn't. It sure did benefit the insurance agencies. Also, Obama provided $1.5 billion to help states launch programs for paid family medical leave. He promised to expand the Family Medical Leave Act to include leave for domestic violence or sexual assault, and fully fund the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act for educating children with disabilities. More people were indicted on treason charges than any other president, in fact, in all presidents combined. So a person who was supposed to be for peace and honesty and transparency, just the opposite. Every whistleblower in those 8 years he was in office was brought in under the Espionage Act, 2017 Espionage Act, and whole lives were turned upside down. He could have exonerated. He could have pardoned all of them. He didn't pardon any of them. He imprisoned them. And we have to consider that. The National Defense Authorization Act targeted journalists and free speech advocates. He knew that. He didn't care. He signed the DARK Act that makes it more difficult and costly to label GMOs. There's a dreadful immigration policy. He gave amnesty to 800,000 illegal immigrants, and he launched an assault on the press, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. With the Patriot Act in 2009, he pushed for renewal of key Patriot Act provisions and making it law in 2010 after removing the existing language regarding protections of civil liberties that were in the original bill. Hence, he didn't want anyone to have civil liberties. He weaponized the Internal Revenue Service to go after Tea Party groups, such as denying them nonprofit status. He wooed the big IT tech firms into spying and surveillance game. Facebook, Google, Microsoft, all engaged. He engaged in prosecution of any journalist or whistleblower that exposed anything of his crimes. And more people were indicted on treason charges than anyone else. There were more persecutions of whistleblowers and would-be whistleblowers. He created the Contracts and Influence database to track and disclose how much federal contractors spend on lobbying, but they are getting, and now well they, how well they are completed in their different jobs. He ended the no-bid contracts above $25,000. He eliminated all oil and gas tax loopholes and special tax breaks. He created a $60 billion bank to fund roads and bridges and to create up to 2 million new direct and indirect jobs and stimulated approximately $35 billion per year in new economic activity. He failed to prosecute the bankers for counting control fraud. Obama's claim of great job growth was shown by Harvard and Princeton analysts to be a primarily part-time only jobs, 94% of his so-called job growth claim. Women suffered a loss of 354,000 jobs during Obama's first term. The median household income declined 8%, equivalent of losing a month's pay every year. Income only rose for the top 20% in America. The number of women dropped from the workforce rose by 4.5 million in his first term. Housing policies destroyed a generation of black wealth. Employment for black teens fell 19% during his first term. Poverty lows in 96% of U.S. household districts. Child poverty lows rose 20% to 8 million kids in poverty. Overall poverty rates rose 16% under Obama. He talked about the required publicity or publicly traded financial partnerships to pay the corporate income tax. And also, he forbid companies in bankruptcy from giving executive bonuses. His attorney general, Eric Holder, expanded the warrantless spying, surveillance, and across all the agencies. And so these are just some of the things that he did. And so that's important. Yes, he did some things would be considered good, but an awful lot of things he did which were not. Where people lost their lives, their freedom of speech, their lives were taken in drone attacks. He has not been held accountable for any of these crimes against humanity. After leaving office, the only thing that he's achieved is amassing an obscene amount of wealth in real estate. He's instrumental in shutting down Bernie Sanders' campaign, and he erected a garish museum for himself in Chicago that destroyed cherished green space and a fragile urban ecosystem. Those are just a small number of the things that he should have been held accountable for. Whatever he did that was good, that benefited all people and not just the party that elected him, fine. Give him credit for that. But don't give him a pass when so many countries were destroyed under him. So many people died because of him. Now, We have another person who has something to say about this, and that's Jimmy Dore. This is a clip from Jimmy Dore explaining why he believes Obama was the worst president in history. Let's hear what he has to say.
Barack Obama has been one of the worst ex-presidents ever. Now, I've said this, he was the worst, one of the worst presidents ever. I know a lot of people think he's a great president. It's because the media is owned by the people who own Barack Obama. So the media made you think he was better. But if Mitt Romney did the things that Barack Obama did, that the Democrats would be screaming about it. If Mitt Romney took us from two wars to seven, if Mitt Romney kicked 5.1 million families out of their houses while he made sure the bankers got their bonuses, if Mitt Romney built cages and deported twice as many Hispanics as Donald Trump did, they would be screaming. If Mitt Romney dropped more bombs than George Bush, because that's what he did, they would go crazy. But because the media is owned by the same people who own him, you think everything he did was right. You think 20 years of Afghanistan was right. You think destroying Libya was okay. You think bombing Syria was the right move. These were all bad moves. These were all the wrong. These were all not bad moves. These were exactly what the military-industrial complex wanted. And Barack Obama was a bigger puppet of the military-industrial complex than George Bush and Dick Cheney was. And so here we go. This is from Jacobin, right? So now even Jacobin is coming around, right? Jacobin. Ladies and gentlemen, Jacobin, right? The Democratic Apologist magazine. Since his retirement from politics, Barack Obama has displayed an astonishing lack of regard for the public good. Instead of serving his fellow human beings, he has mainly devoted himself to a rigorous program of conspicuous self-celebration. And there it is. It's from Jacobin. Now, Jacobin sometimes does good work, sometimes does. Inside the Obama's Martha's Vineyard home, where Barack is hosting his 60th birthday bash. Now, if you remember, I remember he had a birthday bash on his where nobody wore masks while the same establishment was demonizing and vilifying and calling anybody a white supremacist who questioned masks or questioned any of the COVID narrative. And then here he was having his huge party without masks. You remember that? I remember that. He's distinguished himself as the enemy of labor and a friend of racist cops. NBA players began to go on strike last August after, remember this? We talked about this. So the two times Barack Obama came back into public life, the first time was to crush a strike. So they wanted to go on strike, the NBA, after Jacob Blake, a black man, was shot by police seven times in front of his kids in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Amid a national uprising over the shooting and many other acts of racist police brutality, Obama called LeBron James and players' unions leaders Chris Paul and urged them to get back on the court and finish the playoffs, which they did. Obama was also instrumental in shutting down Bernie Sanders' bid for president. So the two times he comes back into public life, one is to crush a strike, and the second one is to make sure the progressive gets screwed and we get a warmongering corporatist service to Wall Street as our president. When Sanders was leading in the primaries, Obama worked to organize the other rival candidates to drop out and backbite, making it impossible for Sanders to win. He then persuaded the Democratic Socialist senator to drop out of the race. And let's not forget Obama's awful museum in Chicago. Okay, we covered this too. The three-memoir author is erecting a garish monument to himself on Jackson Park, which community activists argue will wreak havoc on cherished green space and fragile ecosystem, as well as upon the legal scaffolding for the very idea of the public interest. In addition to his appalling vineyard mansion, what is mans? I don't know what that word is. Obama, is that supposed to be mansion? Obama is also planning to live in an additional ecological monstrosity in Hawaii, owned by close crony Marty Nesbitt, chair of the Obama Foundation Board, and developed for the Obamas. ProPublica reported last year that the Obamas plan a beach house has a controversial seawall, which protects the estate in storms, but it's illegal because such structures disrupt the flow of the ocean and contribute to beach loss throughout the state. Obama doesn't give a crap. He doesn't care. Not surprisingly, the sellers paid a substantial sum to the state to grant a loophole, which will keep the seawall in place for another 55 years. In Hawaii, beaches are considered a public responsibility and extensive laws exist to protect them, but such easements to property owners are unfortunately common. Community members have been protesting the loss of surrounding beach, demanding the Nesbitt take down the seawall. Instead, the state is allowing he and the Obamas to expand it. God. Like most people with way too much money, the Obamas own way too many homes for the health of the planet. That's right. You're supposed to eat bugs and you're supposed to drive an electric car and you're not
have air conditioning.
You're not supposed to have air conditioning. But Barack could have three huge mansions. In addition to the Hawaii and Vineyard estates, they have 8.1 million nine-bedroom mansion in Kalaroma neighborhood of Washington. They have a nine-bedroom mansion in Washington, D.C. All this real estate in the set. So they have that. They have the Martha's Vineyard. They have the place in Chicago. And then they have this place in Hawaii. All this real estate necessitates an unconscionable amount of flying, sometimes on Richard Branson's private jet, at a time when many middle-class Americans and even corporations are cutting down on air travel because of climate impact. At this point, the Obama's carbon footprint must be catching up to Tom Brady's. We wouldn't expect Obama, a centrist, to become a convert to socialism in his late middle age, though as a young person, he did attend the Socialist Scholars Conference. But as a liberal, he's been badly deficient, squandering his considerable public platform and influence, providing little leadership on any of the major issues of the day, like income inequality, voter suppression, and climate change. Instead, how about frickin' Ukraine or the military-industrial complex? How about Medicare for all? Jesus Christ. Those really? That's your
no kidding.
When he's not actively agitating against social and environmental progress, he's been lounging on the Vineyard and on Branson's yacht. With the obvious exception of Trump, what? Obama might even be less public spirited than many other modern. What? You're still doing that. Even in an article about how horrible Barack Obama is, you still got to say he's not as bad as Donald Trump. Who wrote this? All of them are war criminals who faithfully serve the capitalist class when in power. Okay, so this guy's 99% on it. But Ronald Reagan at least had the decency to retreat from public life into a tasteful and sadly relatable senility. He was senile before he left the presidency, which is why he didn't make any public appearances after he left. Jimmy Carter built houses for poor people and defended democracy in Venezuela. He also pushed the CIA and FBI lie about Donald Trump in the 2016 election being fraudulent. He also did that. He also tried to turn us into a banana republic by undermining our elections. The exact thing they said Donald Trump did. That's what Jimmy Carter did. George H.W. Bush declined to serve on corporate boards and engage... and engaged in humanitarian activities, raising funds for victims of Hurricane Katrina and the 2000. Oh, he's a great guy, that George Bush, isn't he? He's a super duper guy. Granted, Bill Clinton's business foundation's dealings in Haiti were a travesty. And he has, like Obama, amassed an indecent amount of wealth since leaving office. But he has also, more than Obama, spent time on humanitarian causes like the... Just stop it. Just stop doing that. What are you doing? You didn't have to put that paragraph in this article. George W. Bush has kept a tactfully low profile. Okay. Ex-presidents would be nothing without the trust of the public once the public once placed in them by electing them to the presidency in the first place. After the presidency, all their earning power and cultural influence stems from the fact that people once voted for them. Obama has not only largely opted out of using his high profile to serve the public interest, but he's also chosen insultingly to flout it. It's long past time to end the cult of hero worship around this narcissistic plutocrat.
And now we're going to go to someone that I doubt most of the people in this audience have ever heard of, Professor Sheldon Wolin. He's deceased. I've had him on the program several times, but he's being interviewed 20 plus years ago on PBS by Bill Moyer, and he's talking about fascism by design. I think this is very instructive for where we're at today in our society. Let's hear what he has to say.
Is this what you meant when you wrote that every one of this country's primary institutions is anti-democratic, anti-democratic in spirit, design, and operation?
It is.
That's a strong statement. Every one of the country's primary institutions, meaning
educational institutions, large-scale educational institutions, meaning institutions of government, bureaucratic institutions, major institutions of media and communication, major institutions of a recognizably economic kind as well, and I think large cultural institutions too. Again, something like the media
is anti-democratic. Meaning
that two things: one, hierarchical. They're all hierarchical structures, and hierarchy means inequality. It means inequality of power. Secondly, I think they're fundamentally elitist in character, which is to say that each of them involves a definition of who should lead or control that institution based upon criteria which can only be met by a relatively few. So it becomes a way of excluding.
And that means anti-democratic. You do not consult the people. You do not involve the people. You do not. And yet, as you talk, I keep hearing the criticisms of the last 10 or 15 years. I'm sure you remember them. There's been an excess of democracy, critics said. We have too much democracy, too much participation, growing in part out of the 1960s. Now, isn't there a contradiction there?
No, I think that the notion of there being too much democracy is basically hogwash.
Do we need a revolution?
I think we need radical reconsideration of some fundamental assumptions, but I still believe that that violence and older understandings of revolution are as anachronistic as perhaps New England town meetings, maybe more so. It seems to me the modern societies have reached such a fragility that the notion of overturn and overthrow makes no sense except if one has an unlimited appetite for barbarism, which I don't happen to have, because we've got to deal with where we are at this point. And so consequently, I guess I'm driven ultimately back to questions of education and the possibilities of education in terms of helping to ease away our way into a better kind of world for us as well as others.
What are the skills of citizenship, and how do we gain them? How do we teach them? How do we appropriate them?
I don't think we approach them by the way they're currently being approached. I'm a little suspicious of most contemporary educational reform proposals because the business community is so enthusiastic about them, and they can see, of course, a way in which public funds get used to create job training for private industry.
But if you want to empower people, as you were talking, you obviously believe people need to be empowered. If you want to empower people to function in an economic order, don't you give them a vocational skill that they can go forth with and use to their advantage?
To a degree. The question of what it means to be empowered, I think, is at the heart of the whole issue of educational reform now. But it's being faced only as a job issue, not as a question of what it means for students to be systematically deprived of the kind of knowledge, sensibility, understanding that can come from so-called soft subjects, subjects like literature or later on philosophy or history or some of the softer social sciences. Now, those kind of subjects, I think, teach people not job skills, but they teach people how to interpret their experience, how to interpret what's happening to them. What's the meaning of this? What's the meaning of that? And what literature, history, philosophy, politics gives you an understanding of are relationships of power in ways that aren't handled by more scientific understandings, ways of in which power relates to personal hopes, personal fears, vulnerabilities, and the rest of it. Now, those understandings, I think a person without them is really powerless.
What are the questions you think we must ask as we move toward that rapidly approaching year 2000?
The central question to me is the question of what I would call collective identity. That is, what do we think we want to stand for as a people? And that's what I think the preoccupation with a democratic culture for me is all about. That what I think we want to stand for is not expansion of American power, not the endless economic and technological innovation that I think we're committed to, whether we want to be or not, but really, what is it we want to see ourselves identified with as a people? Do we want to see ourselves identified with notions of cooperation, notions of diversity, notions of respect and encouragement, of different kinds of sensibilities and different kinds of cultures, different kinds of understandings of the world? Or do we want to see ourselves instead basically as the technological power of the world? Collective identity is something that the founders tried to deal with in the preamble to the Constitution, where they mention certain kinds of values.
That we the people, in order to.
In order to, yes, and justice as part of it, and so is defense, of course. But it's a first stab at a collective, at an understanding of ourselves, and why we want to present ourselves to the world.
Is it romantic to think that each of us, high and low, black and white, male and female, has an opportunity to contribute to the answer to that question?
Oh, I think we do, because I think fundamentally democracy and a democratic culture comes down not to big, highfalutin institutions or policies. It comes down ultimately to how we treat each other in our ordinary range of relationships and conversations.
Interesting thoughts from Professor Sheldon Wolin, W-O-L-I-N. But now we're going to listen to two real heavyweights talk about the woke culture, but from their perspectives. Chris Hedges, who I have an enormous amount of respect for, is interviewing a gentleman, Norman Finkelstein, who is one of the strong intellects in our society. Let's go now to that interview between those two.
There are very few intellectuals who have been as attacked, censored, and blacklisted as long and as ruthlessly as the Middle Eastern scholar Norman Finkelstein. He has been hounded out of universities, denied speaking engagements, had his books and scholarship either ignored or dismissed. It is surprising, perhaps, that Professor Finkelstein's latest book, I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, Heretical Thoughts on Identity Politics, Cancel Culture, and Academic Freedom, is a savage attack on identity politics. He likens the current woke culture of the left to red-baiting, when his heroes, Paul Robeson, Pete Seeger, Rosa Luxemburg, Paul Sweezy, and Annette Rubinstein, were marginalized and, in the case of Luxemburg, assassinated. The cancel culture of my childhood, targeted, he writes, in the name of anti-communism, popular leftist movements rooted primarily in class politics. The new cancel culture still targets class politics, but this time round in the pseudo-radical name of identity politics. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Whereas class politics has historically focused on a massive redistribution of wealth from the haves to the have-nots, identity politics, racial, sexual, etc., in the uppermost tier of a social structure left largely intact in all its steep gradations. The primary vehicle of this politics is the Democratic Party, the mass base of which was once the white working class, but which is now in transition to becoming an identity-based party in which identity displaces class as its organizing principle and base constituency. Joining me to discuss woke culture is Professor Finkelstein, woke culture he calls a civic form of McCarthyism, and we will discuss how it buttresses the ruling capitalist class. So you ask the question very early in the book, whether one's ethno-racial identity possesses a vital essence to be protected and preserved, or you ask, is it a fluke of nature that was instrumentalized to oppress and in an ideal world could potentially be eradicated as a social marker? You quote Frederick Douglass, who you note was canceled by Afrocentrics in his day for lacking black pride. Can you talk about that?
I should begin by saying it's not a simple question. As I point out in the book, many of those who came to identify with the left, many African Americans who came to identify with the left, also strongly identified with being African American. And there was a question of how you navigate these, so to speak, two identities. In the case of Paul Robeson, he at one point commented in his little autobiography, Here I Stand, he said, people have often asked me, how do I navigate these two identities of being number one, a champion in the rights of African Americans, but number two, being closely aligned with the Communist Party and becoming a genuine hero, a folk hero of the international working class. And that's not just in some sort of rhetorical sense. If you look at, for example, the Welsh miners, totally revere Paul Robeson. There's a wonderful film in which he stars as a miner called Proud Valley. And you could see wherever he traveled, he made special dispensations to be certain that working people had access to his art, access to his music. If he would speak at Prince Albert Hall in the UK, he would also have a separate concert for working people. When he goes down, you could see it on YouTube. When he goes down to Australia to perform, he goes to a building site to perform for the Australian working class. So he was asked, you know, he asked himself, how do I navigate these two identities? And his response always struck me as of some interest. He said, the more conscious I became of myself being a Negro, the term of the time, the more conscious I became of being a Negro, the more I felt in solidarity with the working classes of the world. He says, it may sound on the surface like a contradiction, but in real life, it wasn't a contradiction. He was able to find some sort of balance between the two identities. And I found it particularly poignant in the case of W.E.B. Du Bois, because, as you know, Du Bois devotes his whole life in a very serious way, not in a kind of showy way. In a very serious way, he had resolved the purpose of his life was to erase what was called back then the color line. And he engaged in very serious scholarly pursuits to that end. Now, at a certain point, he had become radicalized and came close to the Communist Party. He joined the Communist Party at the very end, but I thought that was mostly thumbing his nose at U.S. imperialism before he went off to Ghana. But he certainly came close to the communist or Marxist, if you want, position. And at the end of his life, Du Bois was a very proud person. You couldn't call him W.E.B. Du Bois. You had to call him Dr. Du Bois. He did not accept anyone referring to him without that title, Dr. Du Bois. And he's around 80 years old, and Du Bois finds himself brought before the government legal system for being loyal, being a foreign agent of the Soviet Union, because he was a strong member, prominent member opposing war between Russia and between the Soviet Union and the United States. And he found himself handcuffed, you know, at 80 years old, brought before a judge. Well, you can just imagine for a person of his pride and a person of his stature who had all the claims to being a respected person, suddenly at age 80, being handcuffed. And he says at the very end, he wrote several autobiographies, mostly because he didn't expect to live so long. He died at a very ripe old age. He actually died the night before the March on Washington, 1963, literally the night before, which causes you to believe maybe there is some order in this universe. And at the end of his life, in the last chapter of that last autobiography, it's a very poignant scene, because he goes through everybody who deserted him. He said, when it comes to his 80th birthday, none of the leading black figures, none of the college presidents, all of whom, black college presidents of the HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, none of them would send greetings in support of him. And then he says at the very end, he said, I found a new friendship, a new world, and that was the world of people on the left, not people of necessarily black, people of the left internationally. And he said, that was my new community. And that to me was a revelatory end that he discovered all of the black. He said his name had become unmentionable among young people. Nobody had heard of Du Bois anymore. His name was literally wiped out. There was only one college, by the way. Only one college. It was Berkeley in the, I guess it was the very early 60s or maybe the late 50s, which put one of his books, some professor put one of his books on their curriculum. And he said he was astonished that he was actually on a college curriculum. And he said he found a new world, a new universe, and that was the universe of people who have shared ideas and ideals. And the identity thing, which he devoted his whole life to trying to eradicate, from an intellectual point of view, but also from an activist point of view, he was the editor of The Crisis, which was the news, magazine of the NAACP. He too discovered that there was a world beyond color. So I think I don't want to be dismissive of the kinds of challenges trying to reconcile these various identities is. You have to always be careful of crossing the line to something that comes across as self-hating or I'll just call it self-hating. And I, so how do you claim this universalist identity without coming across as trying to escape your, so to speak, local identity? I don't think those things are very easy to navigate. I frankly, I wasn't, you know, to speak candidly, since we're having a serious conversation here, I wasn't altogether happy with how Frederick Douglass turned out at the end. He became a kind of Democratic Party hack, an apologist for Ulysses S. Grant's corrupt government. Then he was looking for all of these high honors. He went over as a representative of the U.S. to Haiti, and then he became, he had some position in Washington, D.C., I can't recall quite what. I wasn't too happy. And there was a little bit, I felt like, yes, the arguments he made for a universal identity were very eloquent. Actually, the passage I excerpt in the book, and which you've read, comes from a much longer passage. And I gave it to a friend of mine, Deborah Maccabee. I asked her, can you cut it down because I can't print the whole speech? And she said she found it very hard to because it was just so eloquent and compelling. Douglass was a very impressive figure. You know, when you consider that he couldn't even read legally until he was 18.
Yeah.
He digested apparently Robert Burns, Shakespeare, the Bible, Dickens, and you could see it. And I thought he was a little too, in my opinion, was very elegant, but it was also a little bit too glib, I thought, for a complicated question, which anybody who comes from a quote unquote non-majoritarian group has to wrestle with, you know, whether, not because I'm oppressed as a Jew, you know, in the United States, it's completely ridiculous. I'm not oppressed as a Jew, but on the other hand, I have to always be careful about over, so to speak, bending the stick too much in the other direction, and it comes across as self-hating, and you don't want to go there, you know. So I think it's a complicated question, personally. But the, where I have differences with the current focus in identity politics is the arguments they put forth, they have no content. It's not like the arguments are wrong. There's just no argument at all. It's completely vacuous. It's completely empty. It's filled with internal blatant contradictions. Now, we all know life is a complicated place. And it cannot always be reduced to clear, lucid formulas. The problem is that this sort of the stuff you read is just so blatantly, flagrantly contradictory and devoid of any, and, you know, there's what you might call a rich contradiction. That is to say, a person contradicts himself, but it reflects a reality, which is you have to wrestle with that contradiction. These aren't rich contradictions. This is just complete. It's completely vacuous intellectually.
I want to read a little quote from your book that is about that point. You write, affirmative action relies on generic racial categories, but unless each generic category intrinsically correlates with distinct experiences, outlooks, etc., those admitted under it don't necessarily bring anything beyond themselves to the mix. You quote Gore Vidal, who was gay, talking about the gay community, and Vidal says, what in God's name do Eleanor Roosevelt and Roy Cohen have in common, which we could add, what in God's name do Clarence Thomas and Martin Luther King have in common? And I wanted you to speak about that fallacy of a black, brown, a woman, Asian, Jewish, a gay perspective, the idea of proportional representation.
Again, I admit, and I want to be clear about it, I think these are complicated questions. And I have no problem with acknowledging that. So I'm sure you will agree with me if I say, if the choice is between no affirmative action and teaching an all-white class, and affirmative action and teaching a quote-unquote diverse class, you prefer to teach in the diverse class. You don't want to walk into a classroom that looks like the junior version of the Ku Klux Klan. It's not nearly as exhilarating an experience as when you have a diverse, quote-unquote, diverse class. It gives you a sense of, when you have a diverse class, it's a sense of you're, so to speak, cultivating the humanity of the future. People get along, people communicate with each other, they argue, they disagree, but they're respectful. And also before class and after class, there's a real camaraderie, warmth. It's a special feeling. I'll give you an example, and then I'll return to the question. This past semester, I was teaching at Hunter College. And Hunter College is a City University of New York. And it's all first generation college students, sons and daughters of immigrants, overwhelmingly, but also working class kids in addition, all of them keeping down one or two jobs. So it's the rainbow. It's every imaginable type of person is in the class. And one of the things that strikes me, I try to help students gain some self-confidence by learning to stand up in front of class and to speak. And sometimes students do wonderfully, and sometimes students bomb. But even when they bomb, everybody in the class breaks out in spontaneous applause when they're over, when they're finished. You know, a kind of warmth, generosity, and also there, but for the grace of God, no, I could be up in front of that class and bombing. And for me, that's just a wonderful human experience to see the solidarity among students who, as I say, by any reckoning, represent every possibility, every combination and permutation of humanity. So, that having been said, the problem with affirmative action, at least as the court, the United States Supreme Court sanctioned affirmative action, approved of it. It approved of it only under one condition. Our Supreme Court says you can't use affirmative action for rectify historical wrongs. You can't use affirmative action to be compensatory for currently existing racism. You can't use affirmative action because you think if you have more black doctors, they'll necessarily be willing to serve in black communities. The court discounted all of that. What the court said is we'll accept affirmative action on one ground and one ground alone. And that is different life experiences will contribute to enhance the educational experience of everybody at, say, a university. And the problem is, that what exactly is, let's say you admit two African-Americans into a medical school class, or let's say you admit six on the basis of affirmative action. Who exactly are they representing? Are they representing African-American people? Well, not really, because there's no consensus among African-American people on virtually anything. You could say, well, African-American people broadly support police reform. Okay, that's fair enough. But then when it comes down to a policy question, how do you support police reform? Do you want to support defund the police? Well, that's very unpopular in the Black community. Do you want to support increased a police presence in the Black community? Well, that's actually quite popular among segments of the Black community. So when it comes down to policy questions, when an African-American in class, say in a law school class, when he or she speaks up, theoretically, according to the Supreme Court, he or she is representing African-Americans. But of course, that's not true, because there's no consensus among African-Americans on these particular questions. If a gay African-American speaks up in a Harvard Law School class in favor of gay rights, is that representing the African-American community? Is that representing Baptist African-Americans? Is that representing evangelical African-Americans? No, it's just representing this particular person. So the premise of the affirmative action, at least as the Supreme Court laid it out, the premise is simply wrong. An individual does not represent the group. The individual, at the end of the day, represents the individual. That's it. Nothing more and nothing less. Race is refracted through a particular individual with a particular life experience, and therefore with particular position on any of these questions. So I even though I will emphatically stand by, I would prefer not to teach in an all-white class. That's not the world I want to envisage in the future. It's not a world I want to help bring about. I want to help bring about a world which is genuinely, in all of its levels, representative of humankind. I prefer to be at Coney Island on a Sunday than at Martha's Vineyard. At Coney Island on the Coney Island, the beach, on a Sunday, you have every imaginable shape, a color of humanity, everybody getting along, as Rodney King famously said, can't we all get along? Well, Coney Island on a Sunday, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Russians, Muslims, practicing Muslims, everybody gets along. I'd rather be a participant in that kind of, so to speak, experiment than in an all-white class. But I don't think you, to be perfectly honest, I don't think you can make a rational argument for it. I think the Supreme Court tried. I think the Supreme Court failed.
So woke culture comes with very clear delineations and rules and guidelines for those who perpetuate it. And I just want you to talk about how it was used effectively to elect Barack Obama and how it was used to discredit the candidacy of Bernie Sanders.
The Barack Obama presidency, and I know I'm going to use a word but many people may take offense, it was basically, in my opinion, it was a scam. The United States was at in a crisis in 2008, both internationally with the disaster of the Iraq War and domestically with the Great Recession, as it came to be called. And Americans were hungry for a change. They were actually hungry for a radical change. They wanted a rupture with the past. Along came Barack Obama. Barack Obama was basically marketed by David Axelrod and David Plouffe. He was marketed as a morality tale. That is to say, it was a litmus test for the electorate, a litmus test for the electorate, are you a good person or are you a bad person? Obama himself admitted he stood for nothing. It was one of the most amusing parts of his memoir, The Promised Land. He called it a neat trick. The neat trick, I mean, that's his words, not mine. The neat trick was, he said, I stood for nothing. And of course, he only stood for one thing. He was Black. And so it became a morality tale. Normally, elections are referendums on the candidates. But this election was reversed. It was a referendum on the electorate. If you're a good person, you'll vote for Barack Obama. If you're a bad person, you'll not vote for Barack Obama. And the Americans, they whites, about half of whites, they let their, first of all, they wanted the change. And it seemed as if electing the Black president wouldn't be the end of the change. It would be the first step towards a real change that would break with the past. And so Americans, both for self-interest, the society, our country was in very bad shape, but also there was a kind of letting, they let their better angels control their worse angels, and they took the gamble in the sense that their worst angels, you know, were racist, that's okay, and took the gamble with Barack Obama. And but that was what everybody who voted for him thought would be the first step towards a rupture with the past turned out to be the last step. Because in fact, Obama, if you read his memoir, if you read his his campaign managers, Plouffe and Axelrod, if you look at who he chose for his cabinet, right from the beginning, Robert Gates, Hillary Clinton, Timothy Geithner, a critical role for Larry Summers, it was clear that there wasn't going to be any change beyond his identity, beyond the fact that he was Black. And that's awful thin gruel when you're suffering in a system, you know, in the economic system, and you're hoping for real radical change.
And that's it for today's show. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen, and we look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.